Well, man, when you think about The Who, I think of like every CSI show that came out 15, 20 years ago. It always had The Who music. It always brought up these interesting questions. And one of the questions was that opening song, like, I can't explain. I can't explain why this happens, or what love is, or why I do what I do. Songs like that last one even have spiritual metaphors. I don't think I need to be forgiven. What is an exodus anyway? And one of the things that detectives do is detectives are often trying to explain things that can't be explained. Sometimes look at a wasteland of evidence and say, where in the midst of all this evidence can we find something that's true? How do you deduce and get to the facts? So with 2 weeks left in our series, we have opened each week with a cold case, an actual cold case in history, investigated by a detective, three-generation detective from California, Detective Wallace. And it's a case that went cold, and he later was able to solve it. So I actually reached out to him last week, sent him a copy of our services to say, hey, we've been enjoying some of your material, and he was very appreciative of that. So let me tell you about a case that was a particularly interesting one for him because it started off as a case that wasn't even a crime, it was a missing person. The main suspect later for the cold case, but initially was just a husband who seemed to be concerned that his wife had disappeared. His name was Steve Hayes. The year was 2000, and his wife had disappeared, and she said she just seemed to run off or disappeared or got kidnapped. He wasn't sure. He was very worried. Now, they did, when they investigated, found out they didn't have the happiest of marriages. She seemed to be the primary breadwinner and controlled all the money, and he seemed to resent that in some way. It even came out that he was having an affair. But they couldn't explain anything that would lead to thinking that he had done anything wrong. Tammy had disappeared, and again, it was somewhere around May of 2000. Like I said, she controlled the monies, and there was some rumor in the family that maybe she might even be pregnant, and she was going to tell him pretty soon. However, the case ultimately wasn't even investigated as a crime. It was just a missing person case because there was no struggle, no blood, no fingerprints, and no crime scene photos were taken. So there wasn't even a case for him to look back on to investigate. It was just a missing person case, not a crime scene. How would you investigate what detectives call the no body problem? There was no even case in the past to reopen up. How do you take a missing person case and turn it into a cold case for murder, and how would you prove that? We're going to figure out how Jim did that because he begins to apply some of those same principles, not just to crime scenes. He begins to apply that to his journey into faith, where he moved from an atheist to becoming a follower of Jesus by applying his detective skills to the claims of the Bible. Here's a recent interview he did describing some of the questions and conclusions he came to. Let's watch.
Again, when someone says there is no historical record mentioning, you mean there's nothing historical aside from the four Gospels? Because there's a lot of ancients for which there are not four accounts dated within a generation of the events, yet we accept those as historically true. So I just want to make sure, and let me just throw one more thing out to you, Eric. I think this is powerful for me when I was first examining it. We have so much in document evidence related to the story of Jesus. Early document evidence and fragments of document evidence, the manuscript evidence we have for Jesus, especially when you look at how close it is to the actual events that occurred and the robust quantity of manuscripts we have, that if Jesus was a different kind of Jesus, if he was just a teaching rabbi in the first century who did sermons, but he's not a miracle worker, he wasn't born of a virgin, he didn't rise from the grave. In other words, he is no more spectacular than, say, John the Baptist. Just taught some stuff, a dude in the first century. There wouldn't be a single historian, this guy included, who would say that that guy didn't exist. We have better manuscript evidence for that kind of first century character than anyone else in the first century or any other century. Just trust me, there's more impact. But you insert one miracle, and now suddenly he didn't exist. Well, that's not about the manuscript evidence. That's not about the historical evidence. That's about a presuppositional bias against the miraculous. No one has had more impact on the history of humans than Jesus of Nazareth. No one has impacted literature, art, music, education, science, and world religions like Jesus has. No one. I wrote a book on this called Person of Interest. And I'll tell you that the data is unbelievable. And of the three options, he's just a made up fictional story, or he's just a regular dude, or he is who he said he was, you know, myth, man, or messiah. But that, I'm telling you, the third one is the only one that makes sense of the data, because there's no myth you can think of that's had this kind of impact on literature, art, music, education, science, and world religions. And there's no regular human that has had that kind of impact.
Well, that's quite a claim. Quite a claim. And how would you apply that to Jesus? How did he apply that to Jesus? And how might those same principles be used for our cold case we began with? Well, in our series, we've talked about becoming detective combers. And we use the idea of comber as an acronym for being, how do you, detectives use circumstantial evidence, because it can be good evidence, how to be open-minded. We've looked at backing. Are there backing for the claims that you're making? And then lastly, next week, we'll look at eyewitness reliability. So we're going to get some more backing today for these claims that he just made, because those were pretty strong claims. What if every Bible that we had got burned up, got destroyed, was missing? I want to propose to you that the Jesus of the Bible can be discovered without even using a Bible. We have so many secondary sources that quote the original sources in all different continents, all different places, from all different people, that the Jesus of the Bible can be discovered even without using the Bible. There is such a chain of custody related to what was taught about him on every continent. We can trace and see that the story is consistently true. Two, we can use the no body problem, like they do in a missing persons case, to figure out exactly what happened and what's the most probable explanation for it happening. All right, we're going to start with the chain of custody. You can go back one. One thing at Horizon we try and do is we feel like Horizon's a place that if you consider yourself a thinker, and I know many of us consider ourselves thinkers, we want to help thinkers believe. And thinkers, like myself, I believe stuff when I learn stuff that's true. We want to help thinkers believe, but also help believers to think. And so the chain of custody can be a way to do that. It's an undocumented, or it's a documented rather, unbroken trail of evidence from the crime scene to the court, where you can track what happened and see if any changes came in. Let's take a knife, for example. If you have a knife, and let's say when the police first arrive at the crime scene, they report, in their little report, 6-inch knife was found by police and it had blood on it. Well, let's say a detective gets called in. He comes to the same crime scene. He puts that 6-inch knife with blood into an evidence bag, and now we have another part of the chain of custody. We can see the initial report from the police officer. We now have a detective evidence bag. Well, then it gets handed to a lab tech, and that tests that 6-inch knife, not just for blood, but they report a little more detail. It was actually O positive. And you can see the consistent story throughout this. Now imagine a year later, you come to the actual court case, and there's a witness that swears it was a 4-inch knife and it had no blood on it. Well, you'd look at that and say, hey, something happened between step 3 and 4. Right? Something changed. You could easily notice the length of the knife changed and the lack of blood changed. So you would say the chain of evidence says it was the same here, here, here. Oh, here's where corruption came in. And the same thing you can do in history. It was saying the same thing all along here. When it spread out, oh, somebody changed it here and here because it wasn't consistent with what happened before. So let's start with some claims that the Bible originally makes. So when you think of the Bible, most people think of it as a book, but it's really just duct taping together a bunch of separate ancient documents. So I want to talk about them for what they are. They're ancient documents. We have a guy named Paul who wrote dozens of different letters that we have copies of, as well as a historian who talks about his journey separate from him. And notice how he uses this chain of custody argument. He says, I delivered to you first what I also received from Jesus. Jesus died for our sins, according to the scriptures. He was buried, and he rose again the third day, according to the scriptures. So what he's saying is, I'm passing on to you exactly what was handed to me, chain of custody. He says it in another part of that letter, I received from the Lord that which I delivered to you, that the Lord, in the same night in which he was betrayed, took bread. Now, we have 4 separate biographies, different historic books that we have found in different places that we can corroborate each other on. Then on top of that, we have all these letters written by one of the guys referenced in here named Paul. But Luke's kind of part two that he has of his biography. And he's written Corinthians, Thessalonians, a whole bunch of books, Romans, and so we can validate those claims. Now, another follower is a guy named John. This guy claims to be with Jesus. He also says, I'm passing on accurately what I was handed. He says, that which was from the beginning, we were here from the very beginning of Jesus' ministry. And we don't just believe this stuff. No, no, we heard what he said. We are firsthand witnesses. We've seen with our own eyes what happened here. We looked upon the evidence, and our hands have handled it. He's not saying we believe. He's saying we saw, we handled, we're eyewitnesses concerning the word of life. That life was manifested, and we have seen and bear witness and declare to you, we're passing this on to you, eternal life was with the Father. It was manifested to us. That which we have seen and heard, we declare to you. He goes on in a lot more detail to explain the message and the person of Jesus. Now, we don't just have one biography he wrote. We do have that. We then have another letter, this one, 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, and Revelation. We have five separate historic documents we can corroborate related to Jesus from John. Then we have another one written by Peter. So Peter was one of Jesus' followers. Some people think the book of Mark is his testimony interviewed by Mark, but at least we have for sure two letters separate from that written by him. Here's what he says. We did not follow cunningly devised fables when we made known to you the power and coming of Lord Jesus Christ. We didn't make this up. We were eyewitnesses of his majesty. He received from God a message. We were there and saw it. We're going to tell you what happened. And he tells you the story that the other biographies say is that God came down and declared in front of a whole crowd, that's my son, listen to him. Here's Peter's recounting of that. When such a voice came to him from the excellent glory, this is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased. We were there. We heard this voice which came from heaven, and we were with him on the holy mountain. Well, that's kind of crazy. But now we have multiple people in a large group setting say they were there and saw it. All right, so let's apply this then to Jesus using that chain of custody argument. So Jesus is living, you know, dies sometime around 33, 36 AD. So whenever you look at a historic event, you want to see if somebody recorded what happened within the first generation where the eyewitnesses were still alive. And sure enough, all the biographies we have are recorded in that section of the lifespan of the eyewitnesses, where people could still rebuttal it, that didn't really happen. We're just going to take one of them. John, the guy we just quoted there, he wrote about Jesus' life, and we can trace what he wrote between 30 to 70 AD. Scholars kind of debate it, but it's all within the eyewitnesses' time span. Well, John has a guy who is his apprentice or his disciple. His name is Ignatius. He's writing in 100 AD. Then he has a disciple or a friend or an apprentice, and his name is Irenaeus, right, 200 AD. They all quote from each other, and they quote from the original source. So we can see, did things change over time, or did they not? And that's what Jim Wallace is referencing there in his book, Jesus, a Person of Interest, is can we trace over time if it changed? And number two, did Jesus have any impact that we can trace before and after him? So some of the illustrations I'm going to give you come out of this book. As he's trying to say, Jesus was such a person of interest, the manuscript evidence we have is overwhelming. So let me give you one of the pictures. It's a bit of an eyesore, so keep in mind it's about the forest, not the trees here. If Jesus is the main character we're looking at, and we have these eyewitnesses, what you might call the Bible, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. If you got rid of those, we have all these other followers of followers of followers of followers from various dates and various places in time. They all reference their letters and what they saw in a chain of custody. So let me show you how many manuscripts they have. We're going to give you two different numbers. The top number is how many times they quote from the biographies or the Gospels. The second time are times they quote from those letters, John, Peter. We have all those different sources quoting from three different Gospels, four different Gospels, 13 different letters. So even if you lost the Bible, you could still reconstruct the Jesus of the Bible without using the Bible because of the chain of evidence we have in all different directions. And it's not like they all occurred in some corner. These documents were spreading out across the world. These documents hit every single continent. Let me show you. Next slide. Many of these documents found at different time periods were in eastern Syria. Some of them were in Persia. Some of them went over to North Africa. Some of them went down to Egypt, Rome, and Turkey. if you wanted to corrupt the teaching, you'd have to corrupt it at such a fast pace, and you could, seems like it changed over here in Turkey, but that's not what they said in Syria. You could track with chain of evidence what happened if changes came through. And what you find in the chain of evidence is no matter what place you go or where you head, the same basic teaching is taught about Jesus. All of that evidence supports all of the original claims. How he was born, how he lived, what was his mission, what was his vision, what was his main teaching, what was he called, what did he call himself, his crucifixion, and his ultimate bodily resurrection. So the idea that like lots of mistakes came in over time, that's a kind of a nice urban legend, but it just doesn't fit the facts. The chain of evidence supports that the Jesus of the Bible can be discovered without even using a Bible, because we can track it through the chain of evidence. Now, let me give you an example that's a little easier to follow, not quite so nerdy. My dad's a fisherman. He loves going fishing. So my dad just got back from a fishing trip. And on this fishing trip, he called me up and said, "Chad, you're not going to believe this. I caught this 3-pound largemouth bass. It was awesome." Oh, that's great. That's awesome. My dad is a phenomenal fisherman. And so then let's just say, I'm going to make part of the story up just for the point of reference. That part's true. He posts a picture of it on his Facebook page. But Dad's told me what fishermen do when you take a picture on a Facebook page. If you're not a fisherman, I'm going to let in. As soon as somebody takes a picture, you take the fish and you push it toward the camera so it looks bigger. All right? So I do have a picture of the fish, but I kind of know the trick. All right? And it's pretty huge. Let's just say, now here's the part I'm going to make up. Let's just say I talked to a friend of mine. I'm like, "Oh, I heard you went fishing with my dad." He says, "Yeah." "Yeah, we're sitting around the fire, and he told me about this amazing 5-pound fish he caught." "Wow, he told you about a 5-pound fish he caught. That's pretty incredible." And then 6 months later, I go to visit my dad at home, and I'm hanging out with him and his motorcycle group that he hangs out with, and they've been hanging out. I said, "Hey, my dad's president of your motorcycle association. What's the biggest fish he's caught recently?" "You know, he told me about this fishing trip he took about 6 months ago. He said somewhere around a 10-pounder. Right? Isn't that how fishermen work? Right? It went from 3 pounds to 4 pounds to 5 pounds to somewhere near a 10-pounder, right? You could track the chain of evidence and go, "No, I got a picture here." That's kind of the idea. You can do that in history. Or here's a real story for me. If I told you last week I got to see 10 manatees down at my daughter's place, you might say, "Oh, it's the wrong time of year to see manatees. You rarely see 10 near each other, especially this time of year. I'm not sure I believe that." Then I say, "Well, let me show you a picture." And so I took pictures. Here's a picture. We came across these manatees. And so we're walking along this path. That's my daughter and granddaughter. And she loves manatees. And sure enough, right next to us, pop up nostril after nostril after nostril, rolling around in this very shallow water. So my daughter says, "I think I see 10 manatees. I'm like, "Awesome." So I got to take the boat back. You can see the one picture here of me leaving on the boat. And as I go by, I meet somebody on the boat. And I say, "Hey, you better go over there. There's 10 manatees." And so he's like, "Oh," so he takes his boat over to see the 10 manatees. So I go and I drop off the boat, come back. And I said, "Honey, I was telling the boat, I saw on the boat that had 10 manatees." She says, "There were not 10 manatees, and I don't think Sierra said 10 manatees. And I have a tendency to exaggerate." So I'm like, "Okay, well, maybe not." However, that night, our granddaughter wanted to see the video, which we'd taken of the manatees. So we're watching the video, and as we're listening to it, "Oh, look, it's the manatees. Everybody, come on over here." And my daughter said out loud, "Look, I think there's 10 manatees." Now, this wasn't to prove my wife was wrong and I was right in this one time in our marriage. It was actually to show that you could go back to the original source and find out that, oh, that doesn't mean she'd counted right, but did mean that was the accurate story that was passed. Does that make sense? So that's chain of custody. Now, the other problem you have is what's called the no body problem. And that's going to solve this case. When you don't have a body, it was a missing person case. The way you solve that, both for history and for a detective, is you say what happened prior to the event and what happened after the event. We'll call that the fuse, and we'll call this the fallout. All right, the fuse and the fallout. So we're going to start here with the fuse. Related to this couple, right, Steve and Tammy, what happened prior to her going missing and what happened after? Well, here's what happened before. We'll find out a little bit of evidence later that Ted's boss gives him a barrel in June of 1999. We also find out that there's a chemical store that opened in August of 1999. That'll be important, that he couldn't have got chemicals, which we're going to find in a moment, any time before that. That's setting up the fuse. We also realized that he had felt very pressured by his wife because she controlled all the money. In January of 2000, he opened his own auto shop store, finally having some financial independence for the first time. We also learned that the city they moved to, they didn't move there until April of 2000. So the fuse is, whatever had happened had to have occurred after April of 2000. That was the fuse. Now, the second thing we look at is the fallout, all right? We find out in May that he had borrowed that barrel that he got from that store that opened in 99. And we also find out that he bought some chemicals in May of 2000. We also, when Jim decided to reinvestigate the relative, found out that Tammy, sure enough, had said that she was pregnant, but no one had seen her show. So the last time people saw her was in May. If she'd been pregnant and showing, we would know that she would have had a baby or et cetera. The fallout would be a baby would have been born by November of 2000. So from that, we begin to deduce from both sides, whatever happened had to occur within this window. And then we examine the fuse and the fallout to say, what would best explain these facts? And here's some of those facts. When Wallace reopened the case, he found that Steve had indeed borrowed a barrel from his boss, Ted. He could not explain what he was going to use the barrel for. He could not account for the barrel, and no one knew where the barrel was. But somewhere around May of 2000, he had a barrel in his possession. Secondly, they found a receipt, going back to that chemical store, that he had bought large quantities of acid. In fact, 12 5-gallon buckets he got of hydrochloric acid. He couldn't explain why. He couldn't explain what he did with it, and he couldn't explain where it was now. Okay, that's another fact of the case that was part of the fuse. Next, in the re-interviewing with the relatives, they found that sure enough, she was pregnant, and she was going to tell Steve soon that she was pregnant, and that was in fact validated. And even though she knew he was having an affair, he wanted to know that she was indeed pregnant. That was going to change how he was planning to run his life with that affair. Lastly, they went back and re-interviewed Steve. And what they found is that there were several inconsistencies in Steve's story. Number one, initially, his story kept changing. Well, she just kind of ran off. Oh, she just left. Next time, well, you know, she called me one time. The story kept changing over time. Different details every time he retold the story about the day she disappeared. It also turned out he had a new relationship that started either immediately after she disappeared, and some evidence suggested maybe before. The fallout was, this is a guy who was already looking for another relationship, not to have a baby with his wife. And lastly, there were inconsistent accounts all through the story. By combining all that circumstantial evidence, looking at the fuse and the fallout, they ultimately found Steve guilty of killing his wife, and that's how this turned from a missing person case into a crime cold case. All right, so we're now going to apply that same thing. We're going to look at history. What was the fuse of what the world was like prior to Jesus? And then let's look if anything significantly happened after Jesus. Jim says everything changed, music, art, architecture. We're going to zoom in just to the first century and look at the fuse and the fallout. All right, I'm going to give you two primary teachings and historic events the Bible claims. One, Jesus says that he is the resurrection and the life. He predicts his own death. He predicts he will raise himself from the dead. And then sure enough, at least his disciples believed he did that. And he says, he who believes in me, though he may die, shall live. Whoever lives, believes in me, shall never die. All right, well, if that was true and if he could validate it, did anyone absorb that? Did it change anyone's behavior? Did anyone in the fallout act differently than they had before? The second thing he said in his parable is, whatever you do unto the least of these, you do unto me. That every human being suddenly has value. How you treat things the Roman Empire discarded, handicapped, people who were women were property, children, gay, slavery. All of that caste system of Rome dehumanized everybody, unless you're at the top of the caste system. Jesus shows up with this teaching that everybody matters, and how you treat everybody is how you treat your own creator. All right, I wonder if that stuck. What was the world like before Jesus said that? What was it like after he said that? Okay. Because a lot of people have said that. But did that happen around 30 AD? Did it affect anything? Jesus also took this old Jewish teaching from Deuteronomy, which is an Old Testament book, and he said, here's what the whole world's about. Here's what life's about. Love God, says in Deuteronomy, with your whole heart, your whole mind, your all your strength. Next slide. And love your neighbor as yourself. And he defined neighbor as everybody, even your enemies are your neighbors. All the other commandments, everything about living your life and the law and religious stuff hangs on these two ideas. Loving God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and two, love your neighbors yourself. All right, well, if a guy said that, a lot of people have said be nice to people, but he then raised himself from the dead and says, by the way, I could defeat death for you. Did that change anything? Well, let me give you two books. He's written many. A guy named Rodney Stark. I've read all his books. They're all really fascinating. Rodney Stark is a historian and a sociologist. His books are filled with citations to all his claims. As an agnostic, when he first started writing, he began to notice a huge sociological change that occurred starting in the Middle East, expanding across the Roman Empire around 30 AD. He mentioned several of them. Related to death, there were many people who followed Jesus, this very minimalistic, marginalized group of society, not the power brokers, who suddenly began to treat their enemies as their friends. In fact, not just their friends, but their family. There was this new ethic of family. Family is no longer this top-down, you own your wife, you own your kids. Family was like something bigger. A Gentile could be a Jewish friend, a Roman, an Ethiopian, African. There was this new view of family. And you would actually sacrifice for people who are not just in your bloodline. But that changes sometime around 30 AD. Secondly, two plagues go through the Middle East. I can't remember the exact dates, but somewhere in the first century, there's two of them. And he references that it was Christian doctors, often middle class and upper class in that society, who instead of running, because they had the resources to run, they stayed in these towns to care for and provide for other people like it never been seen before. People began to be generous with their money in ways they never had before. There's a Roman centurion, a Roman emperor named Julian, who says these Christians, he calls them Galileans, these Galileans, they are generous with their money. In Rome, nobody gives anything to anybody. But these Christians are generous to their own poor as well as our poor. Shocking fallout of these Jesus followers. A new view of family. People who are willing to give their only begotten life, the only life they have, they sacrifice it for strangers. What would cause people to give their only life for people they don't even know? One, you'd have to know that death's going to be defeated for you. It's not your final chapter. And two, you'd have to say, caring for this person is somehow more important than protecting my own life. Where would you get that teaching? And what kind of validation would prove that on a mass scale? Well, he begins to trace in both his books the rise of Christianity as well as the victory of reason, how Christianity spread, everything we know about freedom and morality and truth and compassion, caring for other people, what we think is common sense today. Romans would laugh at what we think is common sense. We've been so permeated by Christian influence of Jesus in the fallout, we don't realize how different the world was in the fuse. Probably the best example of somebody citing this is a guy named Tom Holland. I've referenced his book a few times. Let me give you another quote in Dominion. He's an agnostic, an expert in Roman history, and says, the fuse is the world you know today was nothing like that prior to the first century. Something happened around 33 AD that radically changed the Roman Empire. Here's how he says it in a quote. All of us today are heirs to the same revolution, a revolution that has at its molten heart the image of a God dead on a cross. What happened to this person of interest changed history as we know it. To live in a Western country is to live in a society still utterly saturated by Christian concepts and assumptions, stamped by the formidable, indeed the inescapable influence of Christianity. Well, if that's true, then what does that look like on an individual level? There was a PhD historian from Australia. She was atheist, and she loved reading The New Atheist, Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and all that. Her name is Dr. Sarah Irving Stonebreaker. She was a Cambridge PhD, Oxford Fellow, Australian. She's reading Richard Dawkins, and As a philosopher, as a historian, she loves it. But then she begins to ask questions of the claims being made by her atheism. And in one of the chapters of this book, Coming to Faith Through Dawkins, I'll lay out her basic argument that led her to faith. Number one, she was taught that science and Christianity were in conflict. But everywhere she looked in history, she said they weren't in conflict. Almost all of our sciences were invented by Christians. Astronomy, microbiology, physics, etc. And she noted a few very specific ones, like Robert Boyle and Robert Hooke, were very strong scientist Christians who she loved and adored and were very much accepted. They weren't in conflict, science and the Bible. She also tracked the basic thinking. Christians claimed that a rational God created a rational world that could be studied rationally. Okay, that holds true. Dawkins was claiming an irrational process created a rational world that could be studied rationally. There's a chain of custody problem here. She also realized that atheism had no objective standard for right and wrong, but also no objective way to measure that humans have value. Do humans have equal value? If everyone's made in God's image, then yeah. If they don't, there's no objective way to establish human worth, human morality, but even meaning. She said the atheistic worldview says a meaningless process created a species obsessed with finding meaning and purpose. Isn't that strange? What if instead a meaningful process created a group of people who searched for meaning and there was a meaning to be found? That would be much more logical. So in her process, she studied history. She studied the Bible itself, let it speak for itself. And she studied other atheists who'd come to faith, like C.S. Lewis. And she ultimately began to see that the evidence led her to the Jesus of the Bible, even though she came at it without using the Bible. So let's look at our evidence today. What are some of the pieces we've examined? Well, let's just take three agnostics, right? We have the Australian historian coming at it from a philosophical, historic view, looking at the claims and bombarding the claims of the alternative view with her own questions and finding it wanting. We then have an agnostic detective using detective skills, deducing chain of custody and the no body problem to say Jesus formidably changed something like no one else ever has in human history, sometime from the Middle East in 33 AD. We have a sociologist studying the same pattern of the fuse and the fallout with all of his books, showing that a new ethic of love, a new ethic of kindness, a new ethic of family, a new ethic of feeling like death could be defeated happened around 33 AD, inspiring doctors and orphanages and caring for people like nothing before. Thirdly, we have manuscript evidence, not just one Bible. We have manuscript evidence from literally thousands of sources we can recreate, and we can examine in the chain of custody if any changes occurred on different continents across different time. Now, that doesn't have to be like, oh, therefore you have to become a Christian, but at least you'd say, okay, this is worth considering. This is worth looking into. And so that's my encouragement to you in this series, and even today, is to take interest in this person of interest. All right, if Jesus really is a person of interest, and if the Jesus of the Bible can be found without ever using a Bible, as I proposed, through evidence, through the manuscript evidence, then what if you and I began to take interest in this person of interest? Yeah, I want to investigate who he is, but I also want to try it out. Somebody asked me the other day, we're on a radio show, Tom Brenneman and I, on Wednesdays, we do this little radio show called Stained Glass, Plain Glass. And he said, what would you do to encourage somebody to just get started in this process who may not believe it? I said, why don't you try it? Just pick one thing Jesus taught and see if what he says works better for you. Try being bitter for a week. Try him forgiving your enemies. See which is going to work out better. Try not worrying about tomorrow with Jesus' words versus worrying for the next week. See how your health's doing. See what it looks like to care for people like you care for yourself for a week. See what it looks like to forgive others. Practice what he tried and see if it doesn't work, if it doesn't change your life, it doesn't make a difference in your life. And sometimes many of us have had caricatures, right? If you're a Bears fan like I was growing up, you know, you've heard about the Packers, you've seen them on TV, but you've never met a real Packer fan. They just wear cheese on their head, right? You don't know a really good one. You might meet one and go, you know what, they're still wrong about football, but they're not as bad as I thought, individually. I would say part of taking an interest in a person of interest, you might want to get into a Bible study, yes, for the evidence, yes, for the questions, but maybe to meet other Christians and go, huh, I thought they were all judgmental, self-righteous hypocrites. I've been to a group now, they're only half judgmental, righteous hypocrites. Right? Sometimes getting into a group can help you break down your caricatures. You start finding out regular people can harass each other and tease each other, and you don't have to be super religious and all serious all the time. But Jesus claims that he would not only defeat death for himself, but he says we all got dead spots. Yeah, I got a big ego, it's a dead spot, and I can try and fix it, I can try and do better. I actually need some outside source to breathe life into me. If you're feeling depressed, I need an outside source of courage, an outside source of hope. This resurrection message that God says, Jesus says, if you will take interest in me and take interest in what I'm saying and what I'm doing, it will breathe life into your marriage. It'll breathe life into your life. It'll bring life ultimately into your dead body one day, because I'll take you to heaven like I did to myself. And what if studying faith, looking to faith, doesn't have to be boring, doesn't have to be mundane? What if it could be an adventure? Like for me, I love learning new stuff. I love hearing alternative theories. What if you said, I want to go on an adventure for the next 3 months, and I want to take interest in this person of interest. I want to see if God can breathe life into me by doing what these other folks did, looking at the evidence, checking out the readings, talking to other people, maybe serving alongside other people, just seeing what it really looks like in other people's life. So on the band, I'm going to invite the band to come out and do this next song. And I was talking to a friend here at Horizon. He said, Chad, I've been coming to the 11 o'clock service for a while now. I finally decided to get in the group. And I don't know what that was. It sounded kind of cultish, honestly. But I got in the group, and I couldn't believe how normal it was, and honestly how much fun it was to ask questions and to not be shut down, but to also have people go, that's a great question. What do you think? And to discuss it together, and like a good philosophy class or a good educational experience or a good existential experience. You just felt like this was really a fun adventure of laughing together, joking around together, but really finding the big questions in life. Is there meaning? Is there purpose? Who am I? So you hear this next song, you're going to recognize this one. Think about Jesus' words. When he says, I came to bring you life and life more abundant. What if that's not just getting to heaven? What if that's getting a little piece of heaven into us by taking your faith as an adventure into new life? Let's listen together.